Notice how here also Thebes is a mythic image. Notice the work that we did before now comes in really handy because you're able to see the symbolic structure of the Bacchae is an arrangement towards an integration of the mythic image base. So what's the technique? To first of all, lay out the mythic image base. You have to work with your image base first. If you don't have your image base out, there's nothing that you can do. There's no way that you're going to understand what the integration is, even if it happens. Or to understand further whether an integration happens or doesn't. So the first step in consciousness, the first step in any therapeia, is to establish the image base. What are we working with? What's going on? If you've been in any kind of counseling, any kind of a therapy, any kind of introspection, you know that the very first thing is you've got to get out of yourself. What is it? And translate it, put it into forms which are consistent with one another. There are very few people that can deal with primordial feelings without bringing images into play. There are some. They're very rare. Somebody of that nature would be like Mozart. Could integrate on pure feeling, didn't need any image base whatsoever. Or Bach, Johann Sebastian Bach. You can go through Bach's works and he never has an image. It's incredible. But the feelings are accurate, incredibly accurate, and the integrations are always exactly right. But usually we have to find an image base. And from that image base, then to generate meaning, and that meaning generation, the generation of meaning, that gives you your mythos, which is the underside of what later will be the form which one understands, which will be the logic of it. The logic of an image base coming together is, first of all, in its mythos. You can't have a logos without having a mythos first. One has to watch oneself and not regress back into the mythos and think that's it. A la Joseph Campbell. A la the Greeks never on Sunday. You can do that, but that's as far as you will ever get. Time and circumstance will make no difference to you. You will always be stuck there. Notice how the mind now, the symbolic focus of the inner self, the mind, becomes indispensable, not as an arbiter, but as anvil, but perhaps the religious term altar. The symbolic self becomes the altar upon which the balance of the mythos and the logos occurs. So that consciousness, in order for itself to really work in its own terms, needs to be grounded in the mythic significance of the image base, but brought together in terms of a symbolic integration, or brought together, as one would say, in a colloquial philosophic sense, in terms of an idea. And as soon as a human being has an idea, the light bulb goes on in the thought bubble, just like in a comic strip. As soon as a human being has an idea of what's going on, they are able from that idea to work on doing something about it. If they don't have an idea, they're lost in just trying to stay afloat against the feelings. Now, if you don't keep thrashing around, you're going to drown in that. But it doesn't do you any good to swim unless you have some place to swim to, unless you have that technique down and some place to go. And if you don't have that conscious purpose, even if you're a good swimmer, you're out in an indefinite ocean, and it just causes you to lose heart. You've got the right technique, you have nowhere to go. So purposelessness with refining people's techniques just induces despair into human beings. We've seen a lot in our time. Almost everybody we know is fantastic on techniques and nowhere to go. And you get into 40, 50, 60, and despair seeps in, just like a leaking ship. And whatever feeling tones there are there, they always have this drone of despair in the undercurrent. And depression begins to just clog the whole scene. It's because this process has broken down. The person is not functioning, is not being made, cannot function. And what comes in as a surrogate kind of a purpose, an imagined goal. I'm going to make 100,000 a year. I'm going to go to China and walk around the Great Wall. And even if one accomplishes these kinds of purposes, they are not real in terms of the existential life which is there. They're projected out images which should belong in the image base and generate meaning for an integration and not be some kind of a conscious purpose. This is like being snared by the world. That's a religious term for that process. One is indeed a lost soul. One indeed suffers exactly what the so-called primitives of the earth used to call loss of soul. There's nothing worse than that. That is really hell. The hell of it is recognizing that there's something that you could do about it, but you can't get to it. It isn't a hopelessness that there's nothing that can be done, but the nagging suspicion that there is something that could be done, but you can't get to it. Don't know what it is. Nothing works. So this quality is exactly what we're working with now. And I'm going to read you a poem by Kandinsky. And then we're going to take a break. This is about this very quality of conundrum. This is about the conscious composition in art, but now framed in terms of Kandinsky's incredible ability to say, what is this process that is going on that leads me into self-deception? All the time leads me into self-deception and has something to do with the artistic process. Just what it is yet to be specified, but there's something right here, if I can just say it. And Kandinsky, this is from Sounds, translated, published by Yale University Press, and the little poem is called In the Woods. I'll read this, and then we'll take our break. He wrote this before the First World War. The woods grew deeper and deeper, the red trunks bigger and bigger, the green crowns heavier and heavier, the air darker and darker, the bushes lusher and lusher, the mushrooms thicker and thicker, until there was nothing but mushrooms to walk on. It was harder and harder for the man to walk, to force his way through without slipping. But on he went anyway, repeating faster and faster and over the same sentence, the scars that mend, colors that blend. To his left and slightly behind him walked a woman. Every time the man finished his sentence, she said with great assurance and rolling her R's vigorously, very clever. Buddy Don, we're missing Don.
He's running tapes off.
We're missing. Is Don up at the top of the?
He's in the
top. Oh, okay. Sometimes he goes to set.
I said he is taping for people, so he has.
Let's wait for. Find you about the. projects that we're working with.
Thank you.
One of them is with poetry, writing haiku. And if you're current, you should already have done a haiku. Next week, you're going to bring some kind of little sculpture that you've been working on. And the following week, bring it in its finished form. When you bring it 2 weeks from today in its finished form, you're going to show what you have briefly and then pass it to somebody else who is going to revise it. That's why I don't want you to invest too much artistic ingenuity on this. The purpose of this assignment is to disclose a problem area in person making and not to make a work of art that's going to be displayed in Civic Center. Now there's a very peculiar kind of reaction that happens when you make something and you've worked at it and you've got it pretty well formed, and then you pass it on to somebody else and they change it all around. We're trying to make conscious to ourselves an image base, some meaning and integration, styles of psychic energy that we deal with, and artistic purposes in consciousness. And we're trying to understand how all of this works in a single tapestry, or a single fabric, as it were. So you have the haiku, which is the first small assignment to begin with. The second is the sculpture. The third is you're all going to make a painting. But that painting is not due here for another 2 months. So you can be thinking about it, you can be working at it. All the time, try and jot down for yourself, just like you did with the haiku, just some thoughts, some feelings, some notes, some circumstances of the composition, of the making of it, some associative thoughts. Because when we get to the history portion, all of these notes that you've been keeping for a year and a half, all of the projects and materials that you've engendered for a year and a half, are going to be put into some kind of an order. First of all, a chronological order. And second of all, you're going to rearrange that chronology into a history. And you want to be able to have as much materia as possible towards establishing a history. Now what's going to come out of this, just to give you a look ahead, is you're going to understand that there are several, if not many, if not a lot, of possible histories. It's like in the Odyssey. Every time Odysseus shows up someplace, he tells a different story about himself. Oh, he was a merchant man out of Crete, got lost in a windstorm. Oh, well, he was this, he was that. And even when he gets home to Ithaca, and he's confronted by the goddess Athena, who he doesn't recognize right away because she's in disguise, he tells a different story. And she, being the goddess of wisdom, instead of saying, "You liar," says, "Wonderful man of many minds, you never stop inventing stories to tell others of yourself. And you never lose track of who you really are and your real purposes that you want to get to." And she loves him in that wisdom, purity of loving the consciousness that knows the truth and yet is able, is facile enough to be able to make, to invent whatever pictures you need for the moment. So that facility of consciousness, that hermetic quality of consciousness, is characteristic of Odysseus. Notice that Odysseus's many-mindedness is exactly the opposite of Achilles' single-mindedness in the Iliad. As soon as Achilles in the Iliad loses his best friend on the battlefield, his anger rises asymptotically and leads to total disaster that curses the whole war victory of the Greeks. Out of all the Greeks that came back from the Trojan War, only three of them were left alive after the first generation. Nestor, Menelaus, and Odysseus are the only three that survived out of the thousands that went to the war. All the rest of them, most of them were not killed at Troy, and most of them were killed when they came back to their own countries. It was a cursed event. So the many-mindedness of consciousness is needed to balance the single-mindedness of the hand. Notice here the archaic flavor of the colloquial phrase, when something happens beyond human control, it's the hand of God. One never hears a colloquial phrase, it's the eye of God. It's the hand of God that did this. There's nothing we can do about it. The hand of God. In the sense that this is the way it happened, there was no other way for it to happen. Single-mindedness in the hands, many-mindedness in the eye. The composition of the person must be fluid, must be mobile. The health of consciousness is to have several histories, but that one does not allow for self-deception. You don't make a history and then believe that that's the only history that's possible. So we'll be looking towards that. In the high summer, we'll be dealing with those kinds of problems. You can see that in our time in particular, because of distorted social mores, we have the sense that self-deception is tantamount to lying to oneself. And so you cling to the hope that you're going to discover the truth. God damn it all. And you can see that this is ready-made that sets you up for the glass chin. There's no fluidity. There's no humanity. There's no openness to the vicissitudes of life. Things change. Conditions change. It doesn't mean that reality has been betrayed. It doesn't mean that life has been exhausted. It means conditions are different now. That we'll go another way. All right, we can't go this way. We'll go another way. We will make a new way if need be. You see? So when we get to these problems later this summer, you can see that what we're working with now are the seed core experiences of making conscious to ourselves the meanings, the values, and the consequences that are coming up. The sculpture assignment is a very good one. You make an expression from yourself in a medium, maybe for the first time in your life, and what happens? You have to pass it over to somebody else who destroys it, who changes it, who does it according to what they want to do with it, revises it. So you have both experiences. You have the hands-on, and you have the conscious quality, and you have to balance them. How are you going to balance them? You have to bring your mind into play. You have to bring your symbolic understanding into play. Oh, well, this is happening in an educational sequence. This is a 2-year cycle. And what we did the first year, now we're doing it differently in the second year. All of this has a very broad, deep significance. And in order to give you a little quality of this, I'm going to give you a couple of paragraphs from one of the best studies done on the mythic image of Dionysus done by Carl Perenyi and published in the Bollingen series, this huge volume on Dionysus. And I'll give you a couple of the paragraphs here. He's talking about how a new myth in an age of cultural interpenetration, the myths of one culture arrive in a new culture, and there's a resistance to that. We have our own myths, and these myths are coming in. What a tremendous shock this is. And as long as there's an isolation of cultures, you don't have this problem. But as soon as you have anything larger than a couple of villages, you begin to run into this problem. And the more attenuated human contact is, the bigger the problem becomes, until finally it becomes the problem. Alien mythologies becomes a real problem. Because the image base that one has founded one's sense of person on is challenged at a fundamental level. How is it challenged? Not only right or wrong, but here's an alternative. Well, if there's one alternative, how many alternatives are there? How many ways of human are being human are there? One of the great documents that came out of the middle of the 20th century by an anthropologist, Jean Lisitsky. He presented four ways of being human. He has a little book on four ways of being human that's been reprinted many, many times. It was an anthropological takeoff on a basic book, the first book ever done in this style by an American anthropologist some 40 years before, Ruth Benedict, called Patterns of Culture, where she took three different cultures. And Ruth Benedict, one of the great American minds, American anthropology is a fantastic discipline in its early days. And Ruth Benedict, one of the real geniuses of that. And in her Patterns of Culture, she shows that there are many ways of being human. And this problem of intercultural contact, which in our time is just, from a negative standpoint, is an epidemic. But from a positive standpoint, something new can come out of this. Must come out of this. Or we slide back into the kinds of cultural stagnations of making icons out of what once were mythic images. We refuse to look at anything else. We refuse to respond to anything else. We will have only this, only what we are used to, only what we know is right. And you can see that these are powerful problems. The Bacchae by Euripides addresses itself to this, the problem of the arrival of a different mythology. And the resistance, and notice that the resistance comes up from the subconscious core of the person. It isn't that one consciously rejects this, it's that the feeling is wrong. This is wrong. This is not right. This is not our way. One has to make conscious to oneself that this whole ensemble of feelings and events are part of a scene, part of a symbolic set. A problem of consciousness and civilization that needs to be met. That the personality cannot be fluid, cannot be open, cannot take advantage of transformation even when it occurs, unless one is conscious of this. One has to grow. One has to go beyond one's backyard, as it were. Carigny, who is an excellent mythographer, one of the best, writes about how Thebes itself possessed a myth of resistance, which Euripides chose as the theme of his Bacchae, because the core of the tragedy was always already implicit in the story. He amplified it with the motif of the god's departure and return, which also stems from the cult, and so adapted it to the stories of arrival. Originally, there was no arrival in the Theban myth. The punishment which followed the sacrifice as a complementary rite had spontaneously given birth to the prosecutor, to the persecutor, who resisted and thus earned suffering, Pentheus. Now notice as this is going on, that again, Thebes in Greece is the center of a crisis in consciousness in Greek tragedy. Where else in Greek tragedy was there a crisis of consciousness that was centered in Thebes? In Sophocles, the Oedipus Rex trilogy is centered in Thebes. Why? Because there was something between Greece and Egypt. There was an affinity between archaic Greece and archaic Egypt. The Greece of 1600 BC was very affine to the Egypt of 1600 BC. The Greece of 400 BC was not affine to the Egypt of 400 BC at all. It was a crisis in civilization and consciousness that had something to do with Greece and Egypt that had had a consonant cultural historical background, developed in different ways. And when the different ways came together, they clashed. So that the ultimate solution, the ultimate resolving solution to this problem was the one that Alexander the Great saw. I mean, he's called Alexander the Great not for nothing. He saw that the only way to restore to health the person-making capacity of the Greek spirit, the Hellenic spirit, was to bring Greece and Egypt back together in terms of a higher synthesis. And being Hellenic in his outlook, his teacher was Aristotle, he saw that the symbolic vehicle of bringing that back together was to establish a city, a polis. So he established a Greek city on Egyptian territory, Alexandria. It was the ultimate solution, the ultimate resolution to an impossible conflict. And while it worked in Alexandria, it didn't work in Egypt as a whole. I can bring out the Cambridge Ancient History. And I can show you a map of Ptolemaic Egypt. And in black lines are all the Egyptian roads. And in red lines in a superimposed page are all the Greek roads. They didn't even use the same roads. The Greeks had a totally different road system from the Egyptians. The Greeks said, we're building new roads, use these roads. The Egyptians said, no, we're using our roads. It's like an incommensurateness. It's like having a body with two different nervous systems. And so Egypt became a loggerhead problem in civilization that is still unsolved. And the resolution that Alexandria came up with was never able to be carried through to the rest of Egypt, although an attempt was made in the second century of the Common Era, second century AD. And that attempt was the attempt to take the Alexandrian Hellenistic synthesis in a early Christian mythos and extend it over Egypt that way. And to the extent that the Alexandrian dynamic held, that happened. And you have today 4 or 5 million Coptic Christian Egyptians who live in the mindset of Alexandria of the second century AD. But you have 50 million Islamic Egyptians who will have nothing to do with the Copts. It's national law that the Copts may not repair or build any new churches. They can use whatever facilities they have until they crumble into dust, and that's it. We will not cooperate with them. We will not help them. And they will eventually perish into the dust like everything that is not of our own. It's like letting something false just fall off. And why is that so? Because the Egyptian psyche was never Hellenized. It never went for the synthesis. But notice that the problem here first came up around the time of Euripides' Bacchae. It's the first time that the problem really becomes a crisis. There was no problem in 1600 BC. There was also no problem in 600 BC. When Pythagoras, who was thoroughly Hellenic, an Ionian Greek, studied in Egypt for 26 years, he was able to come back. He was able to be an Egyptianized Greek extremely easily. But by 400 BC, 200 years later, there weren't any Pythagoreans left either. They died out because the Greeks would not accept the Egyptian element, just like the Egyptians would not accept the Greek element at all. A lot is made out of the way in which the struggle of ancient Judea against Egypt for maintaining health of traditions. Almost nobody talks about that the same thing happened with the Greeks also. The very same thing. It's not just a resistance, but it's a resistance with a purpose of rejection. We're not only going to fight this thing to slow it down, we're not going to have it at all. So that in the Bacchae, you have the resistance that matures to the point of rejection. But the rejection backfires in the Bacchae. How does it backfire? It backfires because that psychic energy, which was involved in the resistance that built up to a rejection, has a correlate on the mythic level. And while the masculine control of the society was being effective in its resistance, the feminine counterpoint was developing a resistance to the very culture that was successful on the rejection, and the women reject that culture and become Dionysian minads. They become, in terms of the threatened, endangered civilization, they become mad. Why are they mad? Because they don't go along with anything we say anymore. They won't do anything that we do. So there's a tremendous balance going on here. And the key to it is that there is no inner mind that can hold the two together. Well, yes, there was an inner mind. Everyone has an inner mind, but it's that it doesn't work. The fineness of the point doesn't arrive. One is not able to look within and look exactly to where one is. One sees only the flux and fluidity of problematics. So here it is with Kerenyi writing. It is certain that if Pentheus, a transparent and unequivocal name with the somber meaning man of suffering, could become a man's name at Knossos, it was only because the names of gods, Zagreus, which is a name for Dionysius, as well as Pentheus, were also given to persons. And because in the festive calendar, the god's somber aspect prepared the way for the opposite aspect. What is the opposite of somber? A manic breakout. Notice that's not happiness. Is not happiness. Joy is the complement of stillness. But the complement of somberness is manicness. You know that our grandparent generation used to caution, don't frown too much, your face may become frozen, in that expression. Did you ever hear that? That's like the colloquial wisdom of that depth psychological perspective, that you will engender a stasis out of that kind of expression. That kind of expression engenders its opposite. What is its opposite? Its opposite is manicness. if one sees a somber sky, a thunderstorm is sure to follow. It's like that. So, how is the balance expressed? In the festive calendar, in the cycle, the annual cycle, a somber celebration comes into one of the cycles. It has to be balanced. That in another aspect of that cycle, there has to be another festival which balances it, which is manicness. So just as you have a somber day, one has to have a day of carnival. It's the only way to balance it. And to participate in the wholeness, one participates both in the somber festival and in the carnival festival, both equally. Today we drink and laugh, that day we cry and weep, which is redundant, I suppose, but not when you're somber. Notice that the balance is in matching in the ecology of the mythos and make sure that they're both included. But to really do this on a structural level requires a 2-year cycle, not a 1-year cycle. You cannot include both qualities in the same year. To try and do that forces one cycle to do 2 different contradictory works. One cycle has to mature in that somber day, the second year the cycle matures and festive day. It's a 2-year cycle. And to realize that is very high consciousness indeed. To recognize that is so. The ancient Greeks, the ancient world, in all of its high manifestations, recognized this point. They got that far. Being able to make it work, that's another thing. To know what you have to do is one thing. To make it work is another. Almost none of them made it work. What happens when it doesn't work? One slides back into one half or the other of the old mythos. One regresses back to the old mythos with an imaginative projected solution worked in. So you do things just like you always used to do, only now you tell yourself the lie that we're doing it completely. And that's the state of Western civilization in a large extent today. We do everything right, only half of what we do is just imaginary. It doesn't really happen. And of course your gut level understands that this is not really happening. You're just imagining it. So what does the gut level life energy do? It works on the imagination to try to get it to understand that it's not doing its function right. It's trying to displace life. And that's where you get all the Canadians have a wonderful word for this, wonky imagery. Which of course, if your feelings are magnetized to your image base, if you're not sophisticated enough to make the differentiation, then your feelings get wonky also. And then you walk around wondering what today will bring. It's like that. So here's a little bit more of Karenyi. The Theban cult site of the Dionysian religion was situated in a palace complex, which on the strength of an Oriental cylindrical seal, by Oriental they don't mean Chinese, they mean Near Eastern. It would be at this time period, it would be Assyrian, probably. The Theban cult site of the Dionysian religion was situated in a palace complex, which on the strength of an Oriental cylindrical seal can be assigned to the 14th century BC. exact topographical orientation within the Cadmea, the ancient palace of Thebes, is not yet possible because the present-day city has been built over it. So the palace complex in ancient Thebes, the original palace complex, is called the Cadmea, the place of Cadmus. Just like the royal palace complex at Knossos was named after King Minos, who was the dominant figure in setting it up. It was the Minoan palace. This is the Cadmea in Thebes. And there was at one time, 3,500 years ago in Thebes, a palace complex that was there. Thebes is the first place in Greece that received the Dionysian religion. But some investigations have been made possible by the demolition of modern houses. At one point, the excavators, to their surprise, penetrated directly to foundations from the Mycenaean era, encountering no intervening layers from later antiquity. The Mycenaean era is about 1500, 1600 BC. That is 1,000 years before classical Greece, there was a classical Greek. And in order to differentiate, they usually refer to classical Greece from the time of Plato and Pericles, and they refer to ancient Greece as being back in Minoan, Mycenaean times. There's also an archaic Greece. It was even before that. So archaeological investigators, this would have been somewhere around the 1940s, 1950s. When the Roman traveler Pausanias visited Thebes in the 2nd century AD, only the Cadmea, the city's acropolis, was inhabited, and it alone bore the name Thebai. So in the 2nd century AD, the only place left in Thebes, the village town aspect had evaporated. It all gone. The only thing left was the Acropolis, the palace. Here visitors were shown the Thalamos of Semele, the bridal chamber where Zeus visited her, begot Dionysius upon her, and finally burned her with his lightning. The palace itself was preserved as a sanctuary of Demeter Thesmorphoros, a goddess exclusively of women. Her statue from the waist up protruded from the earth, and she would have been bare from the waist up. The Thalamos can have been nothing other than the Sikos, an enclosure never to be entered, an abaton in the temple which was known to Euripides and which is also mentioned in an inscription in the treasure house of the Thebans at Delphi. In Euripides' Bacchae, Dionysus finds the tomb of his mother in this place, in the palace of Cadmos, before the fire was wholly extinguished. This was a tomb in the same sense as the tombs of Ariadne, in reality altars at which an underworld goddess was worshipped. The god made the leaves of a vine grow around his mother Sikos, the chamber. This may be Euripides' poetic addition, but everything else can be taken as part of the tradition relating to the cult site. There Pausanias saw a wooden cult statue set in bronze, said to have fallen from the heavens at the same time as Zeus's thunderbolt, and to have been given its bronze setting by Polydoros, the son of Cadmos. Beside it, Pausanias saw an all-bronze statue of Dionysius by the otherwise unknown sculptor from the 4th century altar of Dionysius by Praxiteles. The protective bronze setting of the first statue argues in favor of its great age, the Bronze Age. That is to say, the first metal that was used extensively in civilization was bronze. Whenever one hears of bronze, that refers to the Minoan Mycenaean age. Copper is the first metal worked with, but copper does not harden. You can't make a really good alloy out of copper. Copper is is too ductile as a metal to work with. But bronze is the first metal that's sharp enough to take an edge. You can make weapons out of bronze. You can make helmets and shields out of bronze. And so the Bronze Age is the first extension of man's power into the metallic core of the earth for his own purpose.